States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On the show this week, Jill Geis of Dreamcatcher Meadow Stud and Training Center, who is the two-time USDF Sport Horse Breeder of the Year, tells us about their breeding program. And I have a conversation with Lifetime Achievement Award recipient Mariel Barnett. But before we hear from Mariel, we have one item of news this week. The USDF has announced that 44 members have successfully completed the USDF L Education Program in 2014. This program is designed to prepare candidates to enter the USEF's R Judges Training Program, to qualify individuals to judge schooling shows, and to give competitors, trainers, and instructors greater insight into the evaluation process of judging dressage. A full list of those recipients are on the website under News. Just go to usdf.org and click on the tab for news. And now we have an exclusive interview with Lifetime Achievement Award recipient Mariel Barnett. Hello, Mariel. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that I could be here, and thank you for asking me.
Before we look back on your career, Mariel, tell us what it means to you to win the Lifetime Achievement Award.
It's such an honor. I was so totally surprised by it, and I'm just thrilled. I puffed all up about it. It was to be recognized in that way, and it was, you know, it wasn't anything that I even dreamed about. So it was particularly a glorious thing for me.
Well, we want to look back at what obviously has been a glorious career. How did the horses start for you?
Well, they started, I think I was born with a love of them. I rode my first horse. My aunt put me on a horse at 4 years old, and I fell off, probably hit my head, and that was it. But she had me get right back on, and of course I did climb back on. And it's been that way ever since.
Obviously, you got that bug at a very, very early age then. So were you competing as a child?
No, I wasn't. It was very, my father bought me an older horse when I was 8 years old, and it was supposed to be eight. It was supposed to be eight, but I'm sure it was about 28 because he died supposedly when 12 years old. So I imagine he was either probably 32 or something like that. But then I rode horses at boarding stables as I was growing up with no formal lessons. And then, you know, I went through the high school years of, that kind of took me away from it because the interest in boys came up, and then I went off to college, and then I got married and had children. And the first time that my husband and I had enough money to do something extra, he, at that time, fur coats were all the rage. And he said, "Would you like a fur coat?" And I said, "No, I'd rather have a horse, please." So that kind of started it.
Where did the love of dressage begin then, Mariel, for you? Was it at those very early days, or was it something that grew on you?
No, it was, I didn't know anything about it. This would have been probably 1961. I saw Chuck and Carol Grant ride at the Michigan State Fair. And I saw that and I thought, oh, that's beautiful. I want to do that. And that's kind of where the interest started. And then I moved back home. And when I got back home, I looked up the stable that I rode at as a kid, and they were doing dressage, and I went, "Oh, this is perfect." So that's how it started.
Now, was this all in the north for you, in Michigan?
Yes, and that would have been in the late 60s. So there was quite a gap there where I really didn't have any formal training until I moved back to Lansing, Michigan.
Now, who did you train with then in those early days, Mariel?
I trained with Jim and Sharon Rowe, and it was his stable that I rented horses at as a kid. So when I moved back to this area, I of course looked them up, and they were in it. I went, I want to join you, and that's where I started taking serious lessons.
And what were you riding at the time?
I was just riding. I bought a part Arab, part, I don't know what the other part was, but I was riding most any kind of horse. I had a saddlebred. I had a Tennessee walking horse. I would ride just about anything.
So what was it that fascinated you then about dressage and motivated you to want to learn more?
It was the beauty of it and the communication that you could do with your horse. That, you know, it was different than I'd done some showing like Western and some saddlebred and stuff like that where you just go around and around the ring. And I thought there's got to be something more to it. I want to be able to do those movements and teach the horse to do things with me.
So when you were beginning then, were you very career-driven? I mean, were you competitive and wanted to get into the show ring as soon as possible?
I don't think so. I think that, you know, we went, we would show as a stable, and it was more the camaraderie of it. And I love to win, but it certainly didn't happen very much at first. It was pretty deplorable. I wasn't very good. I had to unlearn a lot of just survival techniques that I had done by just jumping on a lot of different horses without any training, so I had quite a hard time to go. And of course, I started it in my late 20s, early 30s, so it wasn't that I had done dressage. I didn't have any fear of being on a horse, and I had pretty good balance, and I could stand most anything at that time. But I can't say at first that the showing was a driving thing, but as I got into it, you know, I wanted to be better, and it was a test, and I did enjoy the winning.
So you became more ambitious, did you?
Yeah. Yeah.
And from the, obviously being inside the arena, you decided that you also wanted to be effective outside and began officiating and judging and so on. What inspired you to do that, Marion?
Well, at first, I didn't have a lot of money, and at first, the education that I could possibly get, I couldn't go to Europe, and I couldn't really afford to go anywhere. But the judges' forums would come into the area. And at that time, they would allow spectators and they'd allow people to come and watch. And my husband and I would come and watch the judges' forums. And so I did a lot of that. And then when the training program, and it was one of the very first training programs, became available, I went through it. And not so much, I don't know that it was more for the education. I didn't pass the first time I went through it. And I shouldn't have passed. I didn't have the experience. So they said, well, I needed more experience. So I thought, well, I think I'll do this. I think I'll get more experience and do it. So it was as if each step I took enticed me to go to the next step rather than maybe having that long range goal. As I was able to do one thing, then I thought, I'll do this. And then as far as the instructor certification program, that all started with the Vi Hopkins seminar in 1979. And my husband at that time was involved in the politics and then going to the USDF conventions. And he had gone that year and he came back and he told me about that Vi was going to have this seminar for dressage instructors and that I probably should go and see if I could get into it. And I applied and I was taken in and it just grew from there.
Well, you were then obviously, you were riding and then you began officiating, but you were also instructing, weren't you? Where did that interest come from?
Well, that came from, well, the stable that I was at, with Jim and Sharon Rowe, they were teaching a class through Michigan State University called Classical Horsemanship. And in that class, they had a whole program and it was made up of practical sessions, which were the riding, but also lectures and demonstrations. And they needed people to do those things. And that's actually where I first started teaching. And at first, it wasn't really teaching. We just had to make sure that the school horses didn't all come into the middle of the ring and stop. And so we'd have to lead them back out. So that's how I started teaching. And then they would give me a few students to teach. And that's how that grew. I was teaching at that stable. And then at about that time, a little bit later, that's when the Vi Hopkins seminar made itself available to me.
Well, then you developed an interest in the Dressage Foundation and was elected to the board there. Why were you so keen to become involved with that? What was the driving force behind that, Marion?
Well, I would say the driving force behind that for me was Lowell Boomer. And he was such an inspiration. And he asked me to, you know, be one of the founding members of the Dressage Foundation. And I thought, oh, what a wonderful organization. Here's an organization that is going to give back to the dressage world. And that's how I got interested in that. I'm just looking at my plaque right now, and it says 1992.
So obviously you were very invested in the future of the sport as well and willing to give so many hours of your own time to volunteering. This, of course, is very important to the sport. We rely on volunteers. But what's your philosophy behind that, Mariel?
Well, I think that I feel as though in the beginning of my career, I took a lot from the dressage. You know, the things like the Vi Hopkins Seminar was made available and the educational things that were made available to me at a reasonable, like I said, I didn't have a lot of money, so I had to do things that were, you know, usually close by me or that were not terribly expensive. And the USDF provided those, that education. So I was taking at that point. And then as my life went on and I was able to make a living from my sport, it just became very important to me that I give back. And part of that, I think part of that was the influence of my father, because that's the way that he felt. And I saw him doing that. And I was thinking about that the other day, that has to be such a strong influence when you see your parents doing something.
Did they have a love of horses then that rubbed off on you?
No. Mine came out of nowhere. they used to, if I would be sleeping in the back of the car when we were taking the trip, if they wanted to get me up, they would say, "There's a horse." I would jump right up. But, yeah, they didn't. They supported me, and my father, like I said, bought bought my first horse when I was 8 years old, and he was a passionate golfer, and he realized that, you know, with something you have a passion in, I believe it helps develop you as a person.
Did you pass on your love of horses to your children at all then, Mariel?
Yes, well, my daughter really loves horses, and both of my children love animals. My son, not so much. He was into motorcycles and things like that. And then the one time that I did get him on a horse, when the horse started trotting, he fell off and hurt his mouth really bad. I think he knocked his teeth out in the front, if I can remember right. So, no, he is supportive of me. But my daughter really loved the horses. And the horse that I was my main horse ended up being my main horse that I took to Grand Prix was a horse that I bought for her. And then she went off to college, got married, and had children and everything. So just went away from it. But that's how that all started.
Well, you've divided much of your time, as you said, to judging and to officiating and obviously teaching as well. Of all those roles that you've played in the sport, Mariel, which do you most feel strongly about that you know, if you had to choose one, which one would it be?
That would be very, very hard because I think that each of those interests or avenues develops a different part of you, and I think I really like the whole combination, and I plan on keeping it that way as, you know, as long as my health is all right.
And what is a typical day in the life of Mariel Barnett now?
Well, I do not ride anymore, but a typical day is that I get up in the morning and usually do what I call my office work, do my email, that kind of thing, do errands. And I teach lessons, and that schedule is quite varied because I at this point, my little niche in teaching is by doing small clinics or going around to people's barns. It's a part, I think, that people really appreciate, that they don't have to haul their horses, that somebody will come to them. So I will teach anywhere from one lesson to up to 8-9 lessons at any one barn. And I have those all scheduled out. And my days now I have a little more variety in them because I'm not riding anymore. I'm in the summertime. I'm an avid gardener, and I enjoy working at my computer.
So when you look back in the rearview mirror, Mariel, what would be those standout milestones for you?
Standout milestones? Well, I'll tell you, winning the Lifetime Achievement Award was that was such a thrill, absolute thrill. And then the other milestone that was sort of like my 15 minutes of glory was I rode my horse Cricket at the very first Inselco finals. Those were the national finals, and I don't even remember what year that was, but they were in Oklahoma City, and I was reserve champion at third level. That was a pretty big deal for me.
And now, and that, if you have to create a legacy, what would that be for future generations? What would you like your legacy to be?
I would like my legacy to be that when I teach and I teach young people, I feel as though I have an opportunity to show them, to be a good role model to them, and to see that, you know, through giving back, how important that is, and developing a a good philosophy in working with horses, because that same philosophy goes over to your relationship with people.
Well, congratulations again, Mario, for winning the Lifetime Achievement Award, and enjoy the sport for many years to come.
Oh, well, thank you very much. It's very special. I am so fortunate to have a life and to have a life that where my work is something that I totally enjoy. And, can I tell you one other little story?
Of course.
Okay. My granddaughter a few months ago asked me, she said, "Grandma, why don't you retire?" And I said, "Why should I retire? I'm doing what I love to do. I think that I would just dry up if I retired. I know, you know, like when we have these bad winter months and sort of stuck inside for a while and go, oh, I need to get out and teach. I need that interaction, that something to look forward to every day."
Well, Mariel clearly is an inspiration to young and old, and congratulations to her once again for winning the Lifetime Achievement Award. Jill Geis of Dreamcatcher Meadow Stud and Training Center in British Columbia is a two-time USDF Sport Horse Breeder of the Year, and she joins us now to tell us about her breeding and training operation in British Columbia. Jill, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Well, you're twice the winner, as I said in the introduction, of the USDF Sport Horse Breeder of the Year. What does that mean to you and your breeding program?
It's an incredible honor for us to have received when there's so many excellent breeders right across North America. And being north of the border, we're just very grateful to be allowed to play in the American backyard anyway. It's really given us some exposure that we really do need, because there isn't a lot of places for breeders to identify what they're doing from other breeders. So it has actually directed quite a bit of interest in what we're doing here.
Tell us about your operation there. When did it start and how did it begin?
Well, it's like most in the horse industry, it's a lifetime passion. I was a Western rider when I was a young girl in Canada, but ultimately ended up becoming a lawyer to help ensure that I could always afford the sport. And my legal practice and experience took me to England, and it was there that I got involved with many aspects and disciplines I hadn't experienced before, from hunting to dressage, and had the great fortune of meeting Carl Hester back before he was a household name, and spent 12 years there training at the Talon School of Education in Cirencester, and with Carl, and then I met the directors of the Verband in Germany for the Hanoverian stud, and never looked back, left the law and started breeding and competing, and after 12 years decided with my partner John Dingle to move back to Canada with our foundation stock to share what the genetics and what we'd learned.
So how did you decide on the Hanoverians, and what was your foundation stock to begin with, Jill?
I really was open to all different breeds, and being based in Europe, had the great fortune of going and doing a number of different equine courses from Portugal to Holland to Germany. And a breeder in England actually took me one weekend with her to the Hanoverian Stallion licensing. And there I met a number of enthusiasts and several directors. And they did a lot of research and was very impressed at the amazing history of the horse, dating back to 1735, where we have genetic records to trace back to, and really was respectful of a very organized philosophy and what they were aiming with their breeding program. So I went back with a girlfriend one weekend to a Verden auction, and ended up coming home with Dreamcatcher, who's now 19 years old. She was then 3, and in my enthusiasm ended up purchasing the most expensive horse in the auction. So I started breeding because I knew I could only do that once.
So how did you choose who to start with then in terms of stallions?
At the same auction, or the licensing, Suzanne Davies had purchased a horse by the name of DiMaggio, who had a provisional license, and she brought him back to Britain at the same time I brought Dreamcatcher back. And I had become friends with Twink Allen, who was the head of the Thoroughbred Fertility Clinic in Newmarket. And at this time, embryo transfer was a fairly new science. And I got Suzanne to agree to allow me to have three of those provisional 10 breedings with a go at embryo transfer with my mare Dreamcatcher. And I was blessed with the so-called triplets, two colts and a filly. And those youngsters at age one were flown back here with their mother to set up Dreamcatcher Meadows. And DiMaggio himself I selected because I noted him actually at the license and then observed him in competition in Britain, and just he was in a league of his own, and researched his bloodlines and thought it would be a wonderful combination with my mare.
Tell us about the breeding stallions you currently have.
We have one of Dreamcatcher's original three embryo transfers was a colt by the name of Dreammaster. And he ultimately was licensed by the Hanoverian Verband, and he stands at stud here. We also bought Charlotte Bredell's Veltmeyer son, Windfall CB, and we also have bred another stallion that's been approved with the American Warm Blood Society. He was a colt that was a result of a 300-day performance-tested stallion we brought back that was a Lordano son. So we have those three stallions standing here. We have a full embryo transfer lab and a rescue mare herd that we transfer the embryos into. So we're pretty much a one-stop shop here. We do everything from breeding to training them up to competition.
How many horses would you currently have then?
Almost 50.
So that's quite a challenge in the winter. What kind of facilities do you have to deal with that?
Well, I'm blessed that John is can do just about anything and does it to a high standard. And what we bought here in this incredible mountain valley was an old cattle ranch that had 11 buildings on it. And one by one, as we've been able to, we've renovated these buildings. So we have numerous different ways of keeping horses. We actually have a very systematic way of raising them in that we have what we call the Girls Club, and that's the embryo transfer recipients that are rescued horses. And they're kept together in a herd so that the foals are raised in a small herd as well, which makes weaning pretty uneventful. And then we stable them in one of the breeding barns, two to a stall from weaning to the next summer. And then in their second year, they actually spend the winter in a field where they can go in-out, have an in-out barn, which helps harden them up and just gives them a sense of being a natural horse. I truly believe it makes them hardier in the long run. And then we bring them back in there that next spring and start working with them in a circular building that's like a large round pen. So we're lucky we have all sorts of different ways of keeping horses here, from classic stable arrangements to these in-out fields. And it really works well keeping them in a herd situation.
So you're able to work the horses through the winter then indoors? The weather doesn't encumber you in any way?
No, we've modified all of the buildings here so that we operate 365 days a year. And, we really have all the equipment and a wonderful residential staff. We also have a number of young people that are here as residential riders. So there's a good team here that can keep everything running no matter what the weather does.
And in terms of the future then, Jill, do you hope to build on this program, or are you going to stay at around the number of horses that you have and stallions?
Well, the rescue herd numbers fluctuate large. I mean, there's always more horses to adopt than we can take, but we do try and re-educate a number of them and rehome them as ridden horses if possible. In reality, it's probably would put too much stress on the facility to take too many more than we have. But all of these horses aren't our own. We usually have anywhere from 10 to 15 horses for sale at any given time. And then we also have a training operation here where we train riders and horses as well.
So how does the future look then for breeding? Will you still breed the same number of mares? Is that the plan?
You know, it really depends a lot on the market. It's very difficult, we find, and it was a bit of a surprise moving back to North America, to find that it's a uphill effort to convince North Americans to buy stock in North America. There's still a sense that we have to go to Europe to buy the best, but ironically, the horses that are born here, not just by ourselves, but by breeders right across the United States and Canada, actually have their origins in stock from Europe. And with embryo transfer and artificial insemination, what we're breeding is just as good, if not better, than what you're able to purchase in Europe. A lot of times, from my experience living there, no matter who you go over with, you don't really get an opportunity to see the A string, as you know, every country wants to keep the best for themselves, for their own teams.
So when does the competition season start for you then in the frozen north, Jill?
Well, we usually don't get out competing until around June because it's 11 to 14-hour drive for us to go to our region of horses, or our region's horse shows in Washington and Oregon. So we have, with the winter lasting longer than our southern neighbors, by the time the horses are shed out and the youngsters are backed and really ready to be in competitive form, June is the earliest that we get out and start competing. And then we take usually 8 to 10 horses at a given time and try and go to 2 or 3 shows while we're on the road because the journeys are so long.
Well, obviously a long winter for you up there. And when would you have mares breeding? When would you expect to see foals on the ground?
We really don't like to have foals arriving before April. However, we do have some thoroughbred customers, and their foals obviously have to be born as close to the 1st of January as possible. So we have the facilities here to operate just no matter what the weather is. And actually, we're milder than... we're in a funny little pocket of climate here in a mountain valley in that we're several degrees warmer than neighboring areas. We're about 2.5 hours north of Vancouver and about 30 minutes from the ski resort Whistler. So we're usually anywhere from 5 to 8 degrees warmer. So really the weather doesn't stop us from operating year-round. And we're blessed with having an organic, this is the seed potato capital of North America, in that there's no viruses in any of the ground. So the hay that we make and such is first class, and the animals have water from a waterfall. So they have pretty amazing natural ingredients that produce a really healthy, happy horse in the long run here.
Well, it sounds absolutely fabulous. I want to thank you very much indeed for coming on the program and talking to us this week, Jill. Thank you so much and good luck with your program.
Well, thank you, and we welcome anybody who would like to come and see us. If you go to dreamcatchermeadows.com, we'd be happy to talk to anybody.
And as I said earlier, the list of all the award winners will be on the website at usdf.org. Whilst you're there, you can also visit eTrack, the USDF's online learning center and resource for dressage and equine education. These podcasts are available for download from the podcast store on iTunes to your smartphone podcast app, so you can listen when you like, on the go. Thank you for your company. I hope you'll join us again right here on the USDF's official podcast. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.